In case you hadn't known before coming here, you're in for a bit of a ride tonight. We're talking about oppression, oppressive systems, deconstructing things. We will end up talking about sex. We'll also talk about dance. We'll talk about writing. And our little roadmap tonight is really what Stephanie already mentioned, our practices of resistance. Or what does resistance mean? What are these practices? Yeah, and so thank you for being here with us, despite the weather. You've made it up here into the tower. Also, just to mention, at 8 o'clock, you will hear the bell ring, because we are in a clock tower, so don't get disturbed by that. Let's go. Christina, you ready? Yeah. See, Stephanie just introduced us in a certain way. She just picked on some things that are parts of our identity. For example, we're both trained, or whatever trained means, professional dancers. There are certain things ascribed and certain categories made when it comes to identity. So, you know, people read us in a certain way, they categorize us. Certain things are ascribed. And my first question to you is, who are you tonight?
Good night to everybody. Good evening. And thank you, Stephanie and Anneli, for making it possible, and all the other workers of the Politforum. I'm super happy for being here. It will be my last public event in Vern before finishing my guest professorship. So it's a kind of farewell also for me from the city. So thank you for being here with me. I was thinking that last time that someone asked that who were I? I decided not to reply, because I would really need, because I don't even know. That is a very metaphysical question. But maybe I can present myself with three small things, professional small things, that the novel we will talk today is this Lachte Sprache. This is a German version, translated by Friederike von Kriegen. And she and I received for the book, she from the for the translation and me for the creation, the prize. I don't know the name in German, so the translation into English, but it was a German prize from the Ministry of Culture. It's a prize for the literatures of the world, so it's for any translation, any book which has been first translated into German. So I'm very happy to repeat it, because normally translators are not recognized with prizes. And I've been with my translator in Salzburg the other day, and for me it's like a super, super, super friend, colleague, and I never knew that I could be able to have such a gang of translators and good friends and defenders of the text wherever it goes. And this is the original version of the novel, Lectura Fácil. It was published first in December 2018. And it won Premio Herralde de Novela, that is a prize for novels in Spanish language. And then the Spanish National, the National Prize for Literature, given by the government of the Ministry of Culture of Spain. So these are the last things. This is the last thing I wrote. And about dancing, I'm very happy to say that tomorrow, for instance, I have a performance in Bergamo, north of Italy, with my dance company, which collective, I would prefer to say collective, Iniciativa Sexual Femenina. We are performing our first piece, Catalina. That that for me, they really complement each other, the two activities, writing and dancing. First of all, because in that way, writing is not anymore a super stillness, quietness activity. And also dance allows me to remain in stillness, quiet silence for many hours. So it's a training for me. Dance is also a training for move, but also for not to move, being seated and writing. This is the best presentation I can do for myself.
And not having answered the question, I have to learn from that when talking to journalists, for example. No, you said a lot that we can unpack here, but I think the reason why I also mentioned identity, or to use something that you may say, is identity fetish. Because I'm sure in writing this book, one could also critique, hang on a minute, four protagonists, they all have a form of disability, and there's somebody writing who doesn't have a visible disability. And I think we fetishize identity and therefore identity politics a little bit. So maybe you'd like to...
Yes, this is one of the... For the protagonists of the book, which are four relatives, they are sisters or cousins or half-sisters, between them, in a very precise point in their lives, they are identified as people with mental disability. So this is an identity that suddenly comes. It comes, and it changes. It changes their lives. It's not for them like a before and after, that declaration from the public administration. They just flow a bit with things, as everybody of us do, until things become really, really, really hard for their lives. And for being autonomous, even for choosing what to have for breakfast or what to wear. So something that originally, this identity declaration was thought for helping them, for making things easier for them, at the end of the day became a super, super totalitarian mechanism to control their lives. So there is a character, Patri, that at some point says, we are mentally disabled, but we are also experts in mental disability. And this refers the non-natural, how artificial is this identity? Because if I can get an expertise on identity, it's like an object of a study. So they know very well how to perform what society expects from them.
It's very much this discrepancy, I also think, from when we come back to our identities, to what parts of our identity are important to us. And some of those might not be so easy to speak about, but we're read in a certain way to fit a system somehow. And what you said is really brought out really beautifully in this book as well. There's this one chapter where it just says, you know, this person has such and such percentage of disability, this person has such, so it's measured in numbers. And I mean, how can you measure a person, an identity, a physical function in numbers? So you're already finding in the form something where you're critiquing this welfare system.
Actually, now that I am starting the creation of a new novel, I'm happy to say that, because for years I was
Yes,
it's touring with the book and defending the book and taking care of the translation and so on. But now, now for reasons which would take hours to explain, but some books from the end of the 19th century came to my hands. One of them from Cesare Lombroso, who was an Italian doctor, one of the first professors or doctors in psychiatry. And he became super famous because maybe you remember this trend in at the end of the 19th century, which consisted in measuring heads and the shape, the physical shape, to determine criminality,
yes.
To determine if a person will a baby will be a criminal in the future. And it was this very positivist hope from the end of the 19th century is still very present in our lives. And one of those examples is in the measuring the disability, mentally and physically. This is still with numbers. And so this comes from the end of the 19th century, and we must remember that in this moment and with these theories of the criminal anthropology, the basis of racism, of contemporary racism, are settled.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the basis of the biological inferiority of women in modern ages is seated also. Because of course, all we, for being women, not also are inferior to biologically to biological men. But I also discovered in reading this it was literature. It's not science anymore, these Lombroso's things. It's literature. At a moment he said that every woman are more, all the women, even normal, he says normal with absolutely normality, even normal women have a higher tendency to crime than men.
Sure.
Because they feel less. Because women feel less. They are less sensitive. They feel less. And this is one of the reasons why they are inferior, because they cannot feel everything that is around. So that's why they can become criminals easier, because at the end of the day, they don't feel.
Yes.
They don't feel.
And then there's this whole next step of also saying, of course, they also then lack rationale. They can't think properly,
exactly,
and therefore, of course, they need to,
exactly.
It's all these things. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting what you said at the beginning, because you also said it would take hours to tell you who I am. And this is exactly what I mean. So when it comes to gender, for example,
uh-huh, yeah.
You know, what does it mean? Sometimes I feel a lot more like a man than a woman, mm-hmm, and so therefore, what do you do with this?
Mm-hmm. Mm, with this thing of femininity that is a great topic of our lives.
it's also the topic of these four women,
also,
I think. It comes in. It weaves
also,
itself
also.
In.
Look, there is. They don't call themselves feminists. But, for example, the Zapatist women, they decided not to call their fight feminist fight, but fight of women. Mm. The first reason is because they didn't want to embrace a very European theory, or at least they didn't want to embrace what feminist theory has as Eurocentrical. So they decided to take from the theory what was useful for them. And in terms of definition, just to use the much more simple, popular word of mujer, la lucha de las mujeres, fight of women. Because they wanted to make the scope of their fight much wider in order to reach people who maybe didn't have not ever listened to the word feminism, haven't heard that word ever. And it made me think, it made me thought how brave they were in using the word mujer, woman, without thinking a lot in the gender, in the gender problematics and conflicts. My conclusion was that this is very perverse, you could say perverse. How the word woman is still super bad connotated, even from the emancipation gender movements. The Zapatists thought woman is a word very problematic, that is it, but the last thing we want them, the system, the Mexican state, to remove from us is the word women. So we want to have the word women and we want to fill it with a different meaning. So when someone asks me about my gender identity, I always say that I would prefer not to talk about identity, but to talk about sexual or gender identity, but about sexual, I don't know how to say this in English. In Spanish, I say devenir sexual. Devenir. How to say that in English?
Come, becoming, right?
Yeah.
It's like...
Or
it's
something that flows.
Yes, it's the process of, it's in flux.
Exactly.
This so, kind of gender identity or sexual identity is in flux.
So something that is not never closed.
Yes.
That there is no... arrival point.
Yeah.
Mm. Yep. But nevertheless, I always defend identity in an strategical way. If I can take advantage in front of the state for the 3-4 miserable things that they gave to us, rights. They call them rights. For being women, let's say, the right to have a secure and free abortion.
Yes.
Of course I will identify myself as woman. Of course. Of course. But the same could be with the identity of person in, that is also coming back to our topic, person with disability. As a person with disability, the state gives you this thing that they call them rights. You have the right to have such a kind of miserable subsidy. Of course, I could defend myself as an identity of person with disability, because otherwise the life would be impossible, because the number of barriers is infinite, never ends.
Yeah, and it just made me think, because it's very much in line with what Hannah Arendt said about being attacked as a Jew. You have to defend yourself as a Jew. So the category becomes important when it's being attacked or taken away from you. Early when you were talking about your new book, you used the word creating. I'm creating a new book. And for me, dance used to always have this moment of something transcendental. It kind of is more, it kind of opens up something. Would you say that dance, what's dance for you in the sense of creation, which is also a very loaded verb?
Yeah, fortunately, I do not need to make a lot of reflection in terms of language on my dance practice. So I am not that used in defining it with words. I say it fortunately because there is a lot of logos in our lives already. So if I can skip logos from one area of activity in my life, I really appreciate that. So, but dance for me is definitely the way for being. Is the way for being in a very intimate way. To have a bigger sovereignty on me.
Yeah.
To have a more intimate knowledge of myself.
That's great, it's eight o'clock, I believe.
That's great. It finished?
Really?
If you haven't seen the clock functioning, I really recommend you to have a look at any hour in
There's a pendulum right in the room next door. It's really nice. Beautiful. If you're at home, you just have to come by tomorrow and have a look at this. It's wonderful. Nice. It's worth a visit.
And what I was saying, yes, more accurate knowledge of myself. And also is this, as I already mentioned, this freedom from logos.
Yes.
So the way to express oneself without being super linked or without having without having the slavery on words and on what words the meaning of words imply. Fortunately, dance can still be very abstract. And I am interested in that abstraction. Because there are things in there are movements that we still can't define with words. Maybe we can identify them.
Yes.
Maybe we can recognize them as something that we saw before. They are similar to, but for me it's a liberation not to have words, the precise words for dance.
I don't know what it's like when you have these rehearsal processes. I remember when I used to be on stage many, many years ago, and I come from a background that has very distinct words for certain movements. But then when we went into rehearsal processes or creative processes, it's almost like their own words were created. So we created a movement that wasn't defined, and then all of a sudden it's called the rabbit on the toilet.
Yes.
Whatever. And then everybody in the room knows, that's that and that movement, right? Isn't that interesting? So that all of a sudden this dance and the physical practice manifests itself in some creative words. I don't know if you have that.
We do. I think all dancers do the same.
Right?
All dancers, choreographers do the same. Yeah. Yeah. For tomorrow, we have the fish kiss.
Fish kiss.
We have fish kiss. Huh? And tiki tik.
Yes.
Another
one. Right.
Tiki tik. And I don't know how is the word? Onomatopoeia in Spanish. How it's in English?
Onomatopoeia. Something like that too.
Yeah. like when words remind you sounds.
Yes.
Of things. Yeah. We do the same. We have fish kiss, tiki tik. And in Spanish also, dedo que salta, jumping finger.
Yeah. Perfect.
It's super dada, super surrealist. Yeah, you are very right. And fortunately, at least I don't know any texts. Has it this methodology of creating words for our movements hasn't been defined theoretically. I'm happy for that, because at the moment, when it comes that it becomes a methodology, that's the highway for losing the freedom.
The moment you try and capture it. So one of your characters, or the characters of this book, is called Nati, and she's also a dancer. And I think it's time that we hear a little bit from her and how she speaks. Also, just to fill in, this prize that you and Friederike von Kriegern won is called Internationaler Literaturpreis des Hauses der Kulturen der Welt in Berlin. And Christina will read a bit in Spanish, and then I will read it in German, just so you get this full power of Nati's language. And just to kind of put it into context, so Nati does dance classes, and her cousin, Marga, at this point is picking Nati up from a dance class, and they're on their way home on the tube. This is kind of where we are. Marga has kind of started in the squatting scene, the ocupas, and something happened in that Nati doesn't quite like, and here we go.
Los anarquistas han echado a tu ligue para protegerte del deseo sexual, prima. Los anarquistas han echado a tu ligue porque piensan que la iniciativa sexual ha sido enteramente de él, que tú, por tanto, has sido seducida. Presumen que tú estás en una situación de debilidad ante el macho que se aprovecha de ti, de que eres nueva, de que eres poco punky, de que no sabes decir que no, como sistemáticamente dicen que no las feministas del Ateneo, de que están empapeladas sus fiestas, de carteles que dicen no es no. ¿Qué grafitearon los de Cambie en la última fiesta que hicieron en la Plaza Málaga? No me mires. No te me acerques, no me toques, coño, y en letras de medio metro cada una. Si por lo menos hubiera un graffiti, lo mismo de grande al lado, que dijera sí es sí, pero ni eso, con lo que un indiscriminado voto de castidad presidía la fiesta entera.
Die Anarchisten haben dein Romeo rausgeworfen, um dich vor dem sexuellen Verlangen zu bewahren, Cousinchen. Die Anarchisten haben dein Romeo rausgeworfen, weil sie glauben, dass die ganze sexuelle Initiative von ihm ausging. Dass du also verführt worden bist, sie gehen davon aus, dass du dem Macho gegenüber in einer Position der Schwäche bist, dass er dich ausnutzt, weil du neu bist, weil du kein richtiger Punk bist. Weil du anders als die Feministinnen im autonomen Zentrum nicht konsequent Nein sagen kannst. Womit tapezieren sie ihre Partys? Mit Plakaten, auf denen Nein heißt Nein steht. Was haben Sie vom Canbiers bei der letzten Party auf der Plaza Malaga gesprayt? Guck mich nicht an, komm mir nicht nah, fass mich nicht an. Fuck und jeder Buchstabe einen halben Meter groß. Wenn daneben wenigstens ein genauso großes Graffiti mit Ja heißt Ja gewesen wäre. Aber nichts da. Ein gleichmacherisches Keuschheitsgelübde beherrschte das Fest. Die Anarchisten wollen dich beschützen, weil sie nicht begreifen, dass du, eine Frau, willst, dass sie dich anschauen, dass sie sich dir nähern, dass sie dich anfassen und dass das auch für einen fast völlig Unbekannten gilt. Die Okupas kriminalisieren den Sexualtrieb genauso, wie sie vom Strafgesetzbuch dafür kriminalisiert werden, dass sie leben, ohne Miete zu zahlen. Sie kriminalisieren den Sexualtrieb von dem Augenblick an, wo sie meinen, dass jeder, der dich anschaut, der sich dir nähert oder der dich anfasst, dich missbrauchen will. Sie ermutigen uns, die Frauen, Nein zu sagen. Sie wollen uns, den Frauen, beibringen, uns zu betrinken, Pogo zu tanzen, zu kiffen und uns zu vermummen, so wie es die Männer immer gemacht haben. Aber eine Sache, die die Männer immer gemacht haben, wollen sie uns nicht beibringen. Sexuelles Verlangen zu zeigen und es zu befriedigen. Die U-Bahn fuhr ein und ich machte wieder eine etwas längere Pause als üblich zwischen den Sätzen, aber dieses Mal nutzte Margarita die Gelegenheit nicht, um dazwischen zu gehen. Sie sah mir in die Augen und zog gelegentlich ein wenig die Brauen hoch. Ich bin nicht sicher, ob ihr Schweigen das der Spirale war, das Schweigen, was den Sprechenden tadelt. Hatte ich vielleicht etwas von einer solchen Tragweite herausgefunden, dass Marga keine Einzelheit verpassen wollte? Für deine Anarchisten geht vom Sexualtrieb eine Gefahr aus. Darin stimme ich ihnen zu. Ficken ist gefährlich. Ficken ist ein Willensakt, ein politischer Akt, ein Moment der Schwäche, in dem alles passieren kann. Von Peinlichkeiten bis zum Tod, von Trance und Ekstase bis zur Auflösung. Die Anarchisten wollen dieses Risiko nicht eingehen. Sie gehen andere Risiken ein, viele und unterschiedliche, aber dieses nicht. Warum riskiert es diese Anarchistengeneration nicht zu ficken? Während die Anarchisten von vor 100 Jahren das sehr wohl getan haben. Diese Frage war rhetorisch gemeint, aber Marga verstand sie wieder als an sich gerichtet. Ein sicheres Zeichen dafür, dass sie mir zuhörte. Sie kannte die Antwort nicht und zuckte mit den Schultern. Dieser Mentalitätswandel wäre eine genauere Untersuchung wert. Erachten die heutigen Anarchisten die Emanzipation des Sexualtriebs nicht für einen Teil ihres Kampfes für die Emanzipation von jeglicher Unterdrückung? Marga zuckte wieder mit den Schultern und ich antwortete selbst. Anscheinend nicht. Dieser Kampf macht er ihnen Angst? Wieder hob Marga die Schultern und ließ sie fallen. Die Geste eines Mädchens, das in der Schule abgefragt wird, aber nicht gelernt hat und die Antwort nicht weiß. Ich antwortete wieder. Sieht ganz so aus. Haben Sie Angst zu Vögeln? Darauf zielen die Schüsse, darauf zielen die Gummigeschosse der sexuellen Einsatzkräfte. Sie haben die sexuelle Befreiung schlicht und einfach als Erkennen und Sichtbarmachen der nicht heteronormativen Persönlichkeit von Schwulen, Lesben, Bisexuellen und Transsexuellen verstanden. Sie haben das hübsche Konzept der sexuellen Dissidenz geprägt, um sich damit dann auf nichts weiter als auf die Oberfläche des Geschlechts zu beziehen, auf die Identität und den äußeren Anschein, also auf genau das, was sich beim Vögeln auflösen sollte. Sexuelle Dissidentin ist die Frau, die sich einen Bart stehen lässt. Sexueller Dissident ist der Typ, der von sich selbst im Femininum spricht. Sexuelle Dissidentin oder sexueller Dissident ist, wer Testosteron oder Östrogene nimmt. Die alle sind sexuelle Dissidenten des Heteropatriarchats. Aber was ist mit den supergeschminkten Frauen, die sich wie Beyoncé kleiden, eine mit Silikontitten und Botox-Lippen, die will, dass man sie anschaut und dass man sich ihr nähert und dass man sie anfasst, weil diese Frau schlicht und einfach Lust hat zu vögeln. Ist sie sexuell Dissident? Sie will damit kein Geld verdienen, sich keinen Vorteil bei der Arbeit verschaffen, will niemanden eifersüchtig machen, sie will vögeln, weil Vögeln für sie das Beste auf der Welt ist. Weil sie den Sex und die beim Sex interagierenden Körper weder idealisiert, noch kategorisiert oder klassifiziert. Sie begreift das Vögeln viel mehr als etwas, überhaupt nicht Symbolisches, sondern eher als Hurerei, in anderen Worten viel eher als Aufgabe, all unser Potenzial in den Dienst der Lust zu stellen. So this is what Nati sounds like.
I agree with her. Just by chance.
But in particular, do you agree?
Just by chance. Yeah, actually, this last weekend was the party of Cambies. The party she describes, Cambies is a squat house, historical squat house in Barcelona. And every year they celebrate in May, May the anniversary of the first occupation of the space, which took place in 1997. Yeah, so it's one of the historical squat houses in Barcelona. And they always do the party in Plaza Málaga, and this time was the same. Last weekend in Barcelona, I was not there. And this description of these super big sentences written on big graffiti written on the square: "No me mires," don't look at me. Don't come close to me. Do not touch me. It was like that years ago. As this year, I have not been. I don't know if they have repeated this scenography. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Everything here. Everything this in this fragment that you read, everything is real. It's documental.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
This also points, if you'd like to comment or share something or have a question, also for those of you at home, maybe you wrote things already. Absolutely fine. We'll continue.
We can continue. Mm-hmm.
I think what strikes me, so let's start with something else first. This book has now also been made into a series, correct? In Spain.
Yes. Muy mala.
Muy mala.
Super bad series.
You know what I find interesting about that? And maybe that's something that we can link into. You know, capitalism has this weird, monstrous way.
Yeah.
It makes everything into its own power again.
Yeah.
So, you know, the feminist movement, all of a sudden you can buy t-shirts with "I'm a feminist." Who earns the money? And somehow I have a feeling maybe this is a little bit what's happening here too.
Yeah,
what do you think?
Yeah, because a big, super big platform, television platform, Movistar Plus, for the Spanish language in Spain and Latin America, bought the rights, and they do what they do. The only thing that they can do that is disgusting things. And actually the director of the series, her name is Ana Rodriguez Costa. She actually told the actresses not to read the book.
You're kidding.
Because she didn't want the book to influence the actresses, because she wanted to give her vision, her personal vision. But she wrote the rights of one book to adapt the book, and actually she's adapting the book. So it's basically, it's like a Forrest Gump do you remember Forrest Gump with Tom Hanks? According to me, very offensive film. So it's a version of Forrest Gump, like 20 years after Forrest Gump, with female characters. And she ridiculizes the mental disability. And of course, the thing that she ridiculizes the most is anarchism. And something that makes me think, it hasn't not also been adapted into series, also into theater, and the theatrical version is much more interested for me. But in any of them, nor in the series, neither in the theater, Nati, the main characteristic of Nati, that is what we can read in the first chapter, where she describes her disability without calling it disability, just as a characteristic of her. That is the syndrome de las compuertas.
Schiebetüren-Syndrom.
The sliding doors
syndrome. Yeah.
And which is the X of the book. Is the axis of the book. It doesn't appear in any of the versions, in Syria or television, not even in Syria or theater, not even pronounced. So the disability of Nati, the character that we have just read, is just called, she's very radical. She's very unadapted to rules. Somehow the directors of theater and series didn't find a way to put it on the stage or in front of the camera. So they decided not to say anything about that. But I still ask myself, why did they decide to invest the money in buying a product to adapt it. Sometimes the answer is that definitely that the entertainment system is empty of ideas, completely empty of ideas, and they need to go to other places to.
It's a bit like a vulture. I think this is the thing that I meant with the capitalist thing. You're a hot new voice now, you know, and now they're all just going a little bit.
And they do shit. That's
yes. Okay. I'm sure you had your fights with them too. You had some fights with them as well?
Yeah,
Reds,
of
I'm
course,
sure.
of course. More with the series than the theater. Much more. At the end of the day, theater was... At the end of the day, the theater version had the same point of view than the novel. But in the series version, the protagonists were the social workers. The novel is a critique to social worker system.
Yeah.
So the anti-heroes are the social workers. In the series, the social workers are the heroes. That is, given more space of discourse, more focus to a category, a professional category, which already has this focus. And treating, it was, yes, this is very easy how to see how they are reproducing the same violences in the series than in the world. The so-called people with disabilities appear as consumers from the state. And
this is clearly, so in Switzerland, there's an association called Avanti Donne, which is a self-representing association for women and girls with disabilities, whatever disabilities. And one of their main points is nothing about us without us.
Yeah, classical, on the other hand, not that difficult to understand.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's also what I find interesting is this fact that, because in your book, what strikes me as absolutely stunning is that each character finds their own form. Mm-hmm. So it's called Leichte Sprache, and we know there's this principle of easy read. Leichte Sprache, Lettura facile. And we have one character, Angels, who is writing a novel in easy read, Leichte Sprache. And it's super interesting because as you follow her along, she writes it in a WhatsApp group. She actually deconstructs this system of Leichte Sprache. Right?
Yep.
So, you know, you give a lot of hand to how the form is of these characters. They find their own voices. They find their own methods of communicating themselves. What is this easy read and leichte Sprache as a concept for you when you write?
I study the methodology of easy reading. I don't know if you are familiar to this system, this methodology. It was born in the 70s in Sweden, Norway, and Nordic countries by an association of libraries, public libraries, because they detected that people, the so-called people with disabilities, couldn't read. The literature that was the books that were in the libraries. So they invented this system for adapting, but also for adapting texts, classical texts of literature, but also creating new ones. Specific literature for people with disabilities. Just defining this like this. Like specific literature for people with disabilities is terrific.
Plus also we just heard Nati. Holy, you know, she talks in a way where I'm kind of like, whoa, bring it on, you know? I'm not so sure, you know, there's nothing easy read about how Nati talks.
Yeah, I decided not to do it in a realistic way.
Yeah.
For two reasons. Because sometimes some readers tell me, Hey, but people with disabilities don't talk like that. And I always reply that my approach in this novel is not a realistic one. But the answer, when I answer that, in fact, I am skipping the main point. The main point is, why do you think there is a way of expression for a determinate collective of people, and even further, why do you recognize certain characteristics in some people as so determinate to create a collective? Mm-hmm. Why there is a collective of people with disabilities and there is not a collective of people with... Actually, nowadays there are collectives of everything. I was saying have the big or small knees, or people who like chocolate ice cream and people who like lemon ice cream. But for me, this is the real debate. Because creating collectives, so creating departments of people, is what neoliberalism does. In order to fulfill its objective of super specialization of society tasks, and this super specialization is perfect for separating people in the fight. Coming back to identity, if we believe that we are mates or colleagues according to or for sharing one certain characteristic and not other, we are automatically thinking that we do not share anything else with those others, other collectives. If I identify myself in this and this and this collective, represented at circles, do you have in mind this thing that is one circle, another circle, another circle? So women, migrant, and poor. And the sections of the intersection of the circle, it's your collective. So this is the intersection of this is your collective. And the other thing is another country that is abroad. Huh? Perfect not to fight together, on the other hand. And perfect not to recognize what should be, this is a very Marxist point of view, it is perfect not to recognize the real differences between us, which are differences of power, of relative power in every situation. So getting a bit back to the easy reading, I started this system of easy reading to write a novel in easy reading inside the novel. And it is very difficult writing in easy reading. This is a methodology thought for professionals. Which give their point of view on things and which share their vision on what clearness or easiness is for people which has been historically silent. Mm. What you already said, Aneli, that everything for them but without them, the same. In this case, I create a character which has a consideration of people with disability, mental disability, angels. And she decided that, okay, as I have read so much books in easy reading, now it's my turn to write in easy reading. But her book, written in easy reading with the easy reading methodology, doesn't fit in the easy reading method that is so well thought for that, for her, that it was supposedly it was the method thought for her, perfect for her. And when she comes to study the rules, she discovers that this is even more difficult than writing normally without rules.
And it's wonderful because you get to follow that journey, and you get to also follow these things that writers have, writer's block. Angel has a writer's block at some point. And I think another one, you know, when we talk about voices and finding form for that, is also the protocols in front of the judges and the protocols of the occupa scene. Maybe it's just me, but at some point I'm like, this is very similar. They have a similar way of communicating with each other. What do you think?
Yes, some people told me in very different countries in the world that the way of communicating in the assembly,
yes,
anarchist assembly, is the same in Granada, that is my city, or Barcelona, or Salzburg, or Dublin. That's funny. That's funny, and for me it's a good news. For me it's a good news. That we have a shared code. That's something that happened to me with Contact Improvisation, Anneli. Because when I, in this period, I am traveling a lot, and sometimes I don't have the time to go to my regular dance training. So to every city that I go for more than one day, I just have a look on internet if there is any Contact Improvisation group to go and dance one afternoon, and to stretch somehow and to dance. And it's surprisingly, even in every city, almost in every city there is a Contact Improvisation group. Here in Vang there are two. And the common language exists from New York to Bern to Barcelona, Granada, or Vienna. So I'm happy that people can recognize themselves in such a language. That makes me feel not that alone in the creation.
And another specialty are the fanzines right in the middle of the book. A fanzine, that's like a word that's constructed of magazine and fan. And it's basically a thing of collages and little excerpts that fans make for fans. And you can have them in everything, from a fan magazine about the Klingons. It came from the science fiction world. And in this particular case, they're almost like instructions for anarchists. And Nati is, again, an author of these fanzines. Maybe we can show them a little bit, because we put them back there, so you can see. They're in the middle of the book. And again, this is something that you wouldn't expect when you read such a book. I can show you also here. There's the whole middle section that is built as a fanzine.
It's a chapter.
Yeah. Yes. Why do you like fanzines? What do you like about them? Because also, we should mention, she has students, of course, and she's asking her students as their final exam or essay that they have to put in, they have to produce a fanzine.
Yep. Yeah, because I discovered that fanzines, the fanzines are something very, very, very familiar for me, which has been with me like books since I was a teenager. But there are people, not only super young people, not only people of 18 years old, but simply people which hasn't moved in the same environments than me, that never had listened about fanzines. That nowadays we can call it a formal gender. I'm sure that it has been theoretically studied and all that. But I didn't put that pressure on my students. I just told them to make the fanzine however they wanted. What I like the most from fanzines, mostly from political fanzines, is that as they are not called to be sold in bookshops, they are not called to be processed by a publishing house, they can be very radical in its way of expression. So censorship is not a fear for a fanzine maker. And that is the most inspiring thing for me. And when I wrote this fanzine for the novel, fanzines were the things I read the most in this period of my life. Fortunately, Barcelona is a city, plenty of squat houses and anarchist libraries and anarchist spaces in general. So there is a big tradition in fanzines. Mm-hmm. And I got very inspired of this, as I said, very radical way of express themselves, not necessarily aggressive, but sometimes, not necessarily violent, but sometimes, but very clear, because there is something pedagogical in fanzines. So for me, the fanzine in Leichtesprache is also written in Leichtesprache, for being very pedagogical in political terms.
And I think, just so that you also get to see the second part, I'm going to say that Nati wrote this one, just because it makes a little bit... She wrote it. And Nati has a big problem with the intellectual Caroline Emke. And I think maybe you should find out why. So I'm going to read a little part, and then we'll talk about that. Das ist jetzt ein Zitat. Gehasst wird ungenau. Präzise lässt sich nicht gut hassen. Mit der Präzision käme die Zartheit, das genaue Hinsehen oder Hinhören. Mit der Präzision käme jene Differenzierung, die die einzelne Person mit all ihren vielfältigen, widersprüchlichen Eigenschaften und Neigungen als menschliches Wesen erkennt. Sind die Konturen aber erst einmal abgeschliffen, sind Individuen als Individuen erst einmal unkenntlich gemacht, bleiben nur noch unscharfe Kollektive als Adressaten des Hasses übrig, wird nach Belieben diffamiert und entwertet, gebrüllt und getobt. Die Juden, die Frauen, die Ungläubigen, die Schwarzen, die Lesben, die Geflüchteten, die Muslime oder auch die USA, die Politiker, der Westen, die Polizisten, die Medien, die Intellektuellen. Der Hass richtet sich das Objekt des Hasses zurecht. Es wird passgenau gemacht. Gehasst wird aufwärts oder abwärts. In jedem Fall in einer vertikalen Blickachse gegen die da oben oder die da unten. Immer ist es kategorial andere, das das eigene unterdrückt oder bedroht. Das andere wird als vermeintlich gefährliche Macht oder als vermeintlich minderwertiges Ding fantasiert. Und so wird die spätere Misshandlung oder Vernichtung nicht bloß als entschuldbare, sondern als notwendige Maßnahme aufgewertet. Der andere ist der, den man straflos denunzieren oder missachten, verletzen oder töten kann. Das ist eben jetzt der kleine Einschub, der da oben ist. Und dann kommt, die Autorin dieser Worte ist Caroline Emke, Journalistin und Schriftstellerin, wie Juan Soto Ivars, das ist ein spanischer Autor und auch Kolumnist, der sie in einem 20 Tage vor dem umgenannten Interview erschienenen Artikel als eines seiner Vorbilder zitiert. Caroline Emke erinnert uns in ihrem Essay gegen den Hass daran, dass die einzige Möglichkeit, Gleichheit zu erlangen oder uns anzunähern, darin besteht, einander besser kennenzulernen. Uns als gegnerische Gruppen zu begreifen, weiß, schwarz, Moslem, Frau und uns als Individuen zu sehen. Sotos Lehrmeisterin ist eine feinere, neoliberale Macha-Fascha als ihr Schüler. Wo Soto die Existenz von Gruppen anerkennt, um sich von ihnen zu distanzieren, leugnet Emke selbst ihre Existenz. Sie meint, dass alle, diese menschlichen Gruppen, die sie aufzählt, nichts anderes seien als Summen von Individuen, Personen oder Menschen mit vielfältigen, widersprüchlichen Eigenschaften und Neigungen. Imke wirft genau wie Soto die Lesben und die Polizisten, die Politiker und die Frauen, die USA und die Schwarzen in einen Sack. Damit versucht sie auf eine sibyllinischere Art als Soto Ivars, uns den Bruch der ideologischen Einheit schlucken zu lassen. Caroline Emke will uns glauben machen, dass die Diffamierungen, die Entwertungen, das Brüllen und das Toben, das sich gegen die Lesben, die Schwarzen, die Juden oder die Moslems richtet, mit dem zu vergleichen ist, was sich gegen die Polizei, die westlichen Länder, die Medien, die Politiker oder die USA richtet. Für Emke ist die Beleidigung eines Polizisten, weil er ein Polizist ist, genauso unrecht wie die Beleidigung eines Moslems, weil er Moslem ist. Damit stellt sie einerseits einen trügerischen Vergleich an zwischen jemandem, der durch seinen Beruf und jemandem, der durch seine Religion definiert wird, und andererseits unterdrückt sie, was alle Humanisten unterdrücken. Und das ist der Unterschied in der Machtposition und nicht der persönlichen Eigenschaften, die ein Polizist als Vertreter der Autorität gegenüber einem Moslem, als Gläubigen einer dämonisierten Religion einnimmt, oder gegenüber einer Frau, weil sie kein Mann ist, oder gegenüber einer Lesbe, weil sie kein Mann ist und mit Frauen vögelt. So basically, Caroline Emke wrote this book gegen den Hass in 2016. And I think she has also been critiqued for not addressing the socio-politic question. And when we talked about it, we were also thinking about what does actually hate mean? And also, you know, nowadays there's, for example, the author Cheda Kurt, who readdresses hate as a political emotion and as something constructive.
I'm interested in that. Yes. Said that she was criticized because when I knew about her, everything was super love, super crush with her, at least in Spain. So could you tell me a bit more about what for which
critiques that I read? So we're not doing an Imke bashing here because I think it's going to fall on our heads. But the critiques that I wrote. So number one, she wrote it in 2016, which is a very special time also in Germany. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of things happening and also in the States that she picked up on. And I don't want to misrepresent her thinking, but her bottom line is we cannot use the same methods as the haters. So the moment we start hating, we're doing exactly the same. And nowadays, this is what Nati says and what you are saying, is that this is exactly wrong. Hate has its place because it is to do with the socio-political question. Some of the critiques that I wrote are actually picking up on that and are saying, yeah, fair enough. But, you know, as Nati says, that if the Muslim is hating somebody, it's completely different to if the police officer is hating somebody.
For me, Emke calls hate what in reality is anger, very legitimate anger due to oppressions. When it comes to talk about the underrepresented subject, political subject. In this case, lesbians, Muslims, what else? Women. And actually, this is, there is something very significant in the fact that an intellectual, an Spanish intellectual as Juan Soto Ibars, which is very right-wing journalist, defends her as one of her referents. At the same time, she considers herself and she's considered as a leftish philosopher. So, for me, this is a symptom of how institutionally, of how the left wing and the right wing in institutional politics are basically the same. Basically the same.
This is when Nati calls her a macho fascia.
Exactly.
Yes.
Macha facha. She calls it the unity of all the oppressors. The unity of all the oppressors. Actually, Soto, when this Spanish journalist Juan Soto Ibarz mentions her, is in an article. I will read the title in Spanish and then translate it into English. Festival solo para mujeres negras o el gueto voluntario de las minorías. That in English would be festival just for black women or the voluntary ghetto of minorities. And in this article he says that if black women had a meeting, it seems like in Paris there was a meeting just for black women, and they didn't allow nor black men nor white women to come to the gathering. So he said that this is a auto-self discrimination. This is creating again a ghetto. So now that the white people in society allow them to be with us, they decide to come back to the ghetto. So he's defending something like, look how big efforts we, the white, have made to include you in our system of privileges, that now you want to be aside. So many people were so pissed for this self-ghetto. Mm-hmm. Of the black women. No one thought that. Why do black women to be just by their own with no white women or black men with them? Is it maybe because the supposedly open spaces, democratic spaces, are not that democratic for them? That they need a particular space for them to express freely? This question never arose. And for instance, in anarchist spaces, it's not strange to have,
of course,
events, yeah, activities just for women, or just for trans, or just for queers. And on the other hand, is the thing that no one critiques, for instance, the meeting of all the members of a super big enterprise for being just them alone without me allowing me to be there and listen about their decisions. Please. or their debates. No. Economically, the super rich people go together without being disturbed at all, and this is not a social problem. What is a challenge is having the underrepresented classes organizing by themselves. But when the big owners, the great owners of the capital in this world, go together, lock themselves in Davos, no problem at all. They have to talk about their things.
And of course, you shouldn't hate them for it too.
Exactly.
Right? And I think this is the main point that you and Nate are making. It's too simple to say hate is something that we shouldn't do. Because hate as a political emotion has also always been framed by a certain way. Like the angry woman, you know, the hateful woman, that's a figure of speech.
And I don't know if in German language this exists. In Spanish it is said feminazi. Feminazi, like a radical feminist, like a angry feminist.
Shouldn't be so angry.
Feminazi. Yes. This is the name given by, of course, the machists and the super patriarchal power subjects.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is another moment of Because we can talk for hours. We can. Of course, we're not going to keep you here for that long, but if you want to.
Yes, we still have 10 more minutes, yes. So we will be happy to.
And we still need to talk about sex, even if it's just briefly. Maybe there's somebody online? Nothing? Okay. So we'll talk about sex then, right? Mm-hmm. We know each other well enough now. Mm-hmm. I actually would like to just start by the question that I'm not going to lead up to. Do you think sex can be a practice of resistance?
I am remembering now this film. In Spanish, it is a Japanese film. El Imperio de los Sentidos. Empire of Senses, I don't know. It's a film from the 80s or 90s in which two lovers get locked themselves voluntarily inside home and they are just fed by a person who worked for them, like a servant or something. And every time that she enters, she goes into the room. The other is super disgusting because they don't wash, they don't clean. They are just having sex and dedicating themselves to the other. The Empire of the Senses, I think it's the title. Do you know the film? Is that one?
Yeah. Im Reich der Sinne. Okay? Mm. Yeah.
If it is maybe it should be judged by every one of us. How do we interpret sexuality, which is a very modern word? Sexuality is like personality. That comes from psychology. It didn't exist before, this thing of sexuality. Or personality. This is something from the beginning of the 20th century. Yeah, I think that the first step to maybe recognize the power of sexual practice is not to consider it as a task of our private sphere, our private world. Yes, sometimes I have the political fantasy that having sex is not something intimate anymore. That you don't close the door. You leave the door open and you do it in the street. But if you do that, the problem, then you are treated as Marga.
Yes.
That is one of the characters, that when you do that, you are automatically pathologized. So is Marga a resistant and a politically revolutionary because her way of behaving through sex? The answer is yes.
Her sexual desire, mm-hmm. Marga's, mm-hmm. is discomforting to this society somehow. Mm-hmm. And you take us also through this judicial procedure that is deciding for her whether she should be, you know, forcefully sterilized.
Sterilized.
Huh. Because something in her sexual practice is not okay for this society.
But the first thing is a misunderstanding. A very, very conscious misunderstanding between reproduction and sex for women, just women with disability. Yes. Now in Spain, since 2020, the forced sterilization, that is, without the consent of the person with disability. So the forced sterilization ordered by the judge has been abolished. But until 2020, then something like the 82% between the 80 and 90% of the forced sterilization made to people with mental disability were practiced to women with mental disability. I'm always talking in the language of the power that is, because they call them women with mental disability. So, with men, no problem at all. Actually, there is a very, very common practice that is taking men with diagnosis of mental disability to have sex with prostitutes, with sexual workers. But for women have not the same
exactly
the
rights.
The same rights. So men are not sexuality of men is not a problem. Sexuality of women is a problem. So for her not to be pregnant, we sterilize her. But when at the same time that should be. Marga says that, okay, so if they somehow make me a surgery which will avoid me to get pregnant, then that means that I can have sex freely. But no. No. They don't want you to be a mom, and they don't want you to have sex simply.
Because there's something uncomfortable in that, something unknown. Mm-hmm. I think it's also, I'm mentioning Avanti Donne again, and a essay that has been written by a lawyer. Her name is Liliane Denise Minder. She wrote it in 2022, and she also found out, because this law has been abolished in Switzerland as well, mm-hmm. but still forced sterilization happens.
It's very common in the world.
Yeah, and it's also this topic of custodianship and guardianship and where do you actually get to say this woman? Where do you get to actually judge this woman? Again, nothing about us without us. And she found in this essay that sterilizations of women with cognitive disabilities is 3 times higher in Switzerland. She wrote this in 2022, than of women who don't have these disabilities.
Yeah, like that. Yeah. And even in countries like Spain that now is legally abolished, there are not still statistics about that. How can we trust the letter of the law if the practice, the normal, the daily life of women declared mentally disabled? They cannot, as I told at the beginning of this meeting, they cannot even decide what are they going to watch on TV, what to eat, what to wear, where to go. They are not allowed even to smoke, to have a beer. How can we believe that the practice of not being forced sterilized it's not still done.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. I come back to this because I have another few minutes, and I think it's really interesting because also you held a speech last year, Frankfurter Buchmesse, mm-hmm. and the title was Penetrieren und penetriert werden. So penetrating and being penetrated. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about language and words and translation mm-hmm. and how there is this connection of a sexual practice mm-hmm. to... you know, writing or translating.
Yeah, I was talking about my gang of translators in this text for the...
And you were talking about love also.
Yeah, because fortunately or unfortunately, we humans are symbolic beings, and language is something symbolic. So sex is also symbolic. So sex also... travels with words. Not in vain, there is such a big tradition, beautiful tradition on erotic literature. And yeah, I remember the first time I read, the first book published in the United States after the decolonization of Great Britain was, the title is Memoirs of a Woman of Love. I don't remember the author is a woman, but she had to sign as a man. And it's the story of in this very trend of the end of the 18th century, very Marquise de Sade, that is one girl which starts her work as a prostitute. And it was the first book, not only the first book published, ever published in the United States, but also the first book I read in English in my life. And I was super surprised how hot could the words be. How hot could be the words? And maybe I was, I don't know, 16 years old. And that happens because for us, sex is also symbolic. I don't mean this is fortunately or unfortunately, because sometimes the symbolism makes you forget all the physical things. I don't know. But by now I write also about sex. I take advantage of being a symbolic being.
And you find a language for sexual encounters in this book as well. So I think maybe this is exactly the clock telling us. End of our road trip. We've covered so much, and yet there's so much to leave out. I would just like to say to you, please read this book. It's absolutely stunning. And these characters, all the wonderful characters in there, they don't leave you for a long time. Christina, thank you for
thank
writing
you,
this.
Thank you, Anneli.
And
thank you for your super nice presentation.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Demokratzer.